Well, I'll tell you what.
Morning, folks. We'll get started. We don't have a quorum yet. Commissioner Ms. Hallbeck, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Members, we're going to start with our what looks like a two-day overview of MPCA, and then we'll see how we get going here today, and then we may have to, depending on how questions go, look at if we have to have an extended visit with MPCA at time outside our regular committee. Hopefully that won't be the case, but depends how many good questions are asked. Commissioner and Ms. Hallbeck, welcome, and you want to introduce yourself and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Paul Austin. I'm the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, and with me today is Myrna Hallbeck. She's the chief financial officer for the agency. I'll just be making a few comments on the front end of the conversation and turning it over to Myrna for the base of the presentation. We've also got a couple of other staffers here who can help out if needed on questions as we go through.
Ms. Hallbeck, welcome, and I would imagine you're going to spend the next couple days with us, so thank you for being here, and if you can introduce yourself and begin. Or as Commissioner, I didn't know if you were going to begin.
No.
Sorry about that.
I'll actually run the first couple slides. I just want to make some introductory comments. Obviously, from a financial management standpoint, some of the things the agency has to do, some of the challenges it faces is managing its budget across the funds that it deals with. And we have federal funding, we have state general funding, we have funding from the remediation fund, we have clean water fund, from the environmental fund, and there's some other funds. So one of the budget challenges that this agency has is just managing across these funds, making sure that the funds are being used for the purposes they were set up for, and still trying to make sure we cover the ground that we need to cover for both our delegated authorities from the federal level and the mandates from the legislature and the other activities that the agency takes on. The agency has done a really good job in the last few years of some proactive fiscal planning, and by that I mean the agency has been able to manage between the general fund and the environmental fund and manage some of the unallotments over the last couple of years and manage some of the fiscal structure. So the budget that you will see that Myrna will present is a little bit easier for us to manage because we have not overstretched our budget in the previous 2 years. Some of it has to do with the work that Representative Guineas has done with our budget. Some of it has to do with some good management of the federal stimulus funds along the way. But that's a pattern you will see. And we've got this ongoing challenge between balancing out our long-range goals and the short-term focus points, whether they be issues of that year or the budget issues as they move throughout the course of a given year. We've got some larger focus areas within the biennial budget, and Myrna will actually talk more about the business plan and the process that the agency goes through, looking from individual work plans all the way out to long-term strategic plans. I just want to talk a little bit about the role of the agency and how it plays out and how you'll see it play out with examples within this budget. The job of a regulatory agency is always to walk in between. You're walking in between different pressure points coming from different sides around a given issue. So there's always a push-pull in any given work area at any given time. And I just want to illustrate a few of those so you can get a feel for how we're thinking about things, and you'll see some of this reflected in how the budget lays up when Myrna goes through it. If you look at water, for example, we're in the third year now of a 10-year project to go on a watershed-by-watershed basis around the state and do sampling and assessment, set up largely with the Clean Water Fund money, set up largely around the goals of the Clean Water Legacy Act and the Federal Clean Water Act. And that's an effort that has been proceeding nicely. We're on track. It's really a very positive step forward, and we're very excited about continuing that project and carrying that forward. You'll see that project reflected in the budget as we move. We also have some new challenges, some other issues that are sitting in front of us. A key one of those is the issue with the sulfate standard. And you'll see a line item in this budget to start to deal with that issue. There's a there's an ongoing need, whether it's sulfates or other issues, to get the science, find the right number, find the right standard that's protective of whatever we want to protect in that water body in this case, and then apply that standard through the regulatory process. Well, that's a big undertaking. And you'll see that the start of one of those projects is sitting in here. If you look at the air, we've got some interesting push-pulls going on. You're looking at the potential for the whole metro area to go into non-attainment for particulates and ozone by 2013 maybe 2015. There needs to be pre-work done on that now. We're doing that work within the AIR program. That's a great thing. That's a good step forward. We've got an interesting group of cooperators and allies and thinkers that are all starting to work on that process because that's a very big deal. It would if the area goes into non-attainment, that means that new air sources wouldn't be allowed. That would really crimp development in the metro area. So this has got all kinds of ramifications, economically, politically, socially, just within the development of the whole metro area. So that's an interesting outward-looking push-pull that we've got going. There's another one that's kind of sideways or backwards-looking. We're getting pressure from EPA Region 5 to start working on our backlog of Title V air permits that are up for renewal. Well, the policy and process that the agency has pursued over the past few years has been to work on new construction or expansions that are creating economic growth first, therefore leaving some of the more rote renewals on the table. Now, as a state, we're kind of in the middle of the pack in Region 5 for having a stack of unrenewed Title V permits, but we're starting to feel some pressure from the federal level on that side. So I just wanted you to be aware of the push and pull that we get also on that side. The other thing that's always worth noting and is of interest is that in Minnesota, the construction permits for air and the Title V permits for air are done together. That's not the case in Iowa. So when you hear the issue brought up particularly around the ethanol industry where they can get a permit in Iowa in 90 days, well, they actually get the construction permit in 90 days. They don't get the air permit, the air emissions permit in 90 days. So there's an interesting push-pull that we have on our southern border between Region 5 and Region 7 of EPA, between Iowa and Minnesota, and those are the kinds of balances that you'll see also in our work and in reflected in the budget as we go through this kind of an exercise. On the land side, you're going to see a closed landfill program in here that is actually winding down, maybe by 2015, with the exception of one very notorious landfill down in Burnsville, we'll be done. Well, that's great. What a great story. I mean, a program that's actually closing out, that's a tremendous opportunity. It's also timely because a whole bunch of the staff that work in that area are about to retire. And so there's interesting push-pulls within the programs where you've got expertise on staff, time on staff, that is coming to a point where the demographics in our agency are changing, and they are going to change rapidly over the next 5 years. So we've got to build new leadership, new expertise internally while we're preparing for closing down the programs that we can, combining programs where we can, and then meeting new challenges like non-attainment if that comes through the front door. Last, I'd just like to say that in terms of other things that we've got to look at and try to balance out, as I've been talking to a lot of people in the last 2 months, a lot of folks are asking for compliance assistance from the agency. Sometimes they're asking for it for free, sometimes they're not. But at the end of the day, what people are asking for is more attention from the regulators in a way to help them come into compliance. That's a great opportunity, and there's a lot of people in the agency who have been doing things like that all along, and we think we can do it even better. The push-pull comes if we start getting cuts at the federal level, and we fully anticipate that our federal funding is going to get cut by the time Washington is through with its work, that we may lose some of our capacity to do some of that assistance. And that doesn't help anybody at the end of the day. So I just want you to be aware of all these cross pressures that are on the agency. This is just a list of them. This is not unusual. This is where an agency always is. But these are the things that we're thinking about and the things that end up reflecting themselves in our budget and in our work plans. And between this biennium and the next biennium, you know, I'm sure we'll be walking through all these areas while we're trying to figure out how to balance it against the need to spend less money at the state level. So that's all I've got for my comments, Mr. Chair. If it's up to you, if it's all right with you, I'll turn it over to Myrna. Otherwise, I'd be happy to answer questions on my comments.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm assuming you're going to leave. That was your plan when you turned it over to...
If that works, all right.
Yeah, I think that's appropriate. I know you got other fish to fry. Commissioner, do you want to say anything about the audit report? I guess I would just like, if you wanted to, I think members may have questions about that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a couple things on the audit report. One is to put it in a little bit of perspective. If you look at the recommendations, they all deal with state-level activity. And this is not a flaw in the report. It's just a reflection of the reality that the information that the auditor had available wasn't really able to discern or address the federal strata or the local government strata too well in terms of the issues around environmental review and permitting. So the recommendations that are there are of value. They make sense to us. Clearly, we've been working on our data systems already for a couple years. We'll continue to do that. This notion of tracking performance and activity and using continuous improvement tools is something the agency has been interested in doing for a while. We're happy to continue to apply it. The issues around EQB and its ability to educate and help local governments deal with their issues is not a new one in this arena. So those are all very valid and very reasonable and things that we're happy to work on. I think the real wild card still remains the most local level. And it ends up reflecting itself in other areas as well. When you look at environmental review and permitting, the question of local capacity is there. If you look at water management, water governance, the most confusion is at the local level. So this notion of somehow looking at our governance structures and trying to decide how to deal with this confusion and or lack of capacity at the most local level is something that we're going to have to work with the counties and cities on as we move forward.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for coming to our committee today. You piqued my interest with the local control comment. You know, I'm sure you're aware of the 4B classification that we've been talking about around the Capitol the last few weeks. Would you care to comment on the potential usefulness of the 4B classification?
Commissioner, and for those members like myself that don't know what Representative Torkelson's talking about, Representative Torkelson, do you want to let us know what 4B? Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, for those of you who aren't quite into the arcanery of water quality standards. When the state sets up water quality standards and classifies waters with the concurrence from EPA, 4B is a particular class of water where you have a known impairment and a known remedy. And so you can classify a water as a 4B and essentially create the opportunity to use some different kinds of planning tools to address that water. It's a version of an expedited TMDL plan, the total maximum daily load cleanup plan that you can use on other waters. This state has only got a couple of waters that are classified as 4B because of known impairments, largely due to ammonia toxicity. What Representative Torkelson is talking about is there potential to use local water plans in place of some of the TMDLs if the local water plans are sufficiently laid out and have the right kinds of information in them. There's two options. One is to kind of have this 4B classification available. The other is to do an expedited TMDL of sorts. We are actually looking at both right now. There's actually a meeting with EPA next week where a number of individuals who are in this conversation will be part of a discussion with EPA about which route seems to make sense to them as well. They're quite different in their timing. Using an expedited TMDL is something you can do today. Using a 4B standard means you have to get waters classified as 4B waters, and that takes a amount of time in the federal process that we may or may not be interested in. So that's a piece of the conversation for next week. So we're making progress on that, and we're going to put that one to bed one way or the other.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like your tie, by the way.
Oh, thank you. My daughter-in-law picked it out and bought it for me, too, and the shirt. I don't have this good a taste, Representative Anderson.
Commissioner, you just mentioned that you've been working on some of these timing issues and moving things along for a couple of years. And now, that to me seems like a fairly long time, and I know you haven't been on the job all that long, but are you seeing any improvement? Are things getting better? Is the process getting better, as you mentioned, going back a couple of years, and what progress is being made?
Commissioner, what's happened in the last month?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in the last month, the staff have been educating me on all the hard work that they've been doing. I can tell you, going back about 5 years, there was a tremendous backlog on water quality permit renewals, and that backlog is largely gone. And I can tell you that the agency staff have had an internal goal of 180 days, comparable to the new 150-day goal that they've been working on for a few years. And they've got, depending on how you're looking at the class of permits, somewhere between 80 and 90% compliance with the 180-day goal and almost the same level of compliance with the 150-day goal. So, you know, there's the knowledge within the agency about the fact that, you know, businesses want more certainty. Speed helps without compromising the protection levels that are there, with being able to cooperate and interact with EPA is something that isn't news. I think the next great frontier is making sure we have the systems to track our performance as well as we could. We're getting there, but we're not there yet.
Commissioner, if I could ask your viewpoint, or just a quick summation, the Environmental Fund, just first to preface it, your agency, I believe, has got $8-10 million of general fund. But the agency is hundreds of millions of dollars of budget items. And I'm just wondering if you could just give me a little short synopsis of where the money comes from for the Environmental Fund, and then where it goes to, and what kind of changes you envision potentially available. You talked about one, if I'm not mistaken, closed landfill fund may get some funding from the Environmental Fund, or maybe I've got that wrong. But, Commissioner, Environmental Fund, if you could just give us a short synopsis of what you think there and what you see as opportunities for change.
Two things. One is, Mr. Chair, we get about $17 million in general fund now. So, and that's...
Commissioner, is that a biennium?
Right.
Okay,
that's
thank
a biennial
you.
Number.
Yes.
Yeah. And the Environmental Fund is about $127 million on the biennium. When I'm talking about the closed landfill program, I'm actually talking as much about bonding as I am about the actual operating funds. So just to put that in context. I think Myrna's going to go into greater depth on the Environmental Fund and where it lays up and where it goes into our budget. I don't know. We haven't sat down necessarily and thought about other opportunities that there may be in there. We've been able to create some space within the Environmental Fund over the last few years to manage back and forth between the General Fund and the Environmental Fund. And when you look at the governor's budget, that's what you see with our General Fund cuts. We were able to absorb those movements over into the Environmental Fund. And that's been our management tool that's been available to us.
But, Commissioner, if I'm not mistaken, and Representative Wagenius may be able to expand on this, the Environmental Fund is going in the direction of being upside down, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm just wondering, I think the scope of the fund has drastically increased. And I'm just curious, first, where does the money come from? Who pays to the $127 million of biennium? Where does that come from? Because it's not general fund. It doesn't come from the general taxpayers that pay income tax. Who actually pays into it? And Commissioner, if you don't have a general idea, Ms. Hallbeck, I know you're going to get into it later, but give us a landscape or synopsis of the Environmental Fund.
Myrna will be able to give you a better answer than I on the full spectrum of the Environmental Fund. So.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Myrna Hallbeck, the Chief Financial Officer, for the record. And the Environmental Fund is made up of a number of fees coming in. The solid waste management tax fee, 70% of that, 30% goes to the general fund. And then our air, water, and hazardous waste fees, so both the application fees and the annual fees that come into there. As of 2009, the enforcement penalties completely come into that, except a few of those penalties that go directly to the remediation fund because they're associated with tanks to do. And then there are some miscellaneous, but those are the motor vehicle transfer fee is the next largest one. And then there's some very small fees that come into it.
Well, thank you, Ms. Hallbeck. And Commissioner, I thank you for being here. Are you okay, Commissioner, for a few more minutes? Commissioner, so the or Ms. Hallbeck, the solid waste tax, is that, are we not supposed to call it garbage anymore? Is that inappropriate? Is that, I always think of a truck going to the landfill holds about 25 ton. So how much does a semi go into the landfill to dump solid waste? Is how much per ton? Is that what we're talking about? That would be people that pay garbage bills then?
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, the fee would be built into the bill that you and I pay to our garbage hauler.
Thank you, Commissioner. And then do I hear a number, Ms. Hallbeck, like $20 a ton or $500 a truckload for what I refer to as semis?
Mr. Chair, members, you pay a couple things. The solid waste tax is actually on the service of going, and then a $20 ton may be the actual disposal fee that you do. And depending on where you dispose of it, it will be a different charge. But the tax is the same for households on the service, and then there's a different level of taxing if you're a business.
And Ms. Hallbeck, if you lived in the metro where land is more precious and landfill space is probably more valuable than if you lived in Rosso, where it was 31 below this morning, Representative Fabian, they probably have more open space, more landfill, so potentially do they pay less in Rosso than in Woodbury?
Mr. Chair, the disposal is really about what type of landfill you have in the generation, and when I ran a landfill, we actually did it based on how much space we had, and the less space we had, the more we charged in order to preserve that and encourage people to recycle. But depending on the different businesses, they may charge it in a different manner.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hallbeck. So, Commissioner, I've gotten somewhat of a quick overview of where the money comes from. Mm-hmm. It comes from all of us, I understand, and if you generate less waste, you would pay less. So I would imagine we're encouraging people for their yellow top dumpster like mine is where the recycling is. If that gets more, less has to go to the landfill, and so then I would pay less. And that's the idea of why the fee may be $500 or more per truckload. So we collect this $127 million, which is 8 times as much as the general fund budget. Then where are some of the bigger pots of that money? Where do they go in this ever-expanding list of projects and things that are good? And then how are we dealing with the fact that we're going to go upside down even at the $500 a truckload?
Mr. Chair, members, the big expenses out of the environmental fund, the very first largest one is the transfer from the environmental fund into the remediation fund to help fund the remediation. The remediation fund was based on a three kind of legged stool, particularly for the closed landfill, which was bonding, insurance recovery, and then part of the environmental fund to make that. So we actually transfer over, and you'll see when we get to it that we're proposing a transfer of $47 million in the FY12-13 biennium in order to keep those closed landfills on their construction path to be finished by 2015, which then reduces the amount that we have to transfer. The other big chunks are our staffing in the environmental area, particularly the permitting staff, the enforcement staff, the monitoring staff. So we have some level of monitoring, both air and water, that occurs outside of clean water fund to do. So we have that component of it. We also have some grants that go out to counties. We have the SCORE grant, which is for recycling out in the counties. We have hazardous waste grants that go. We have a small amount of environmental assistance grants that go. Trying to think of the other bigger ones, but it's really about staffing and then pass-through grants at the largest levels. But remediation is the biggest chunk when we transfer over.
Commissioner and Ms. Hallbeck, will you, when you get to more in-depth, and thank you for the short overview while the commissioner's here, I think it'll be important that we see what things have been added to the environmental fund to draw down from it, because the important things, the closed landfill, the work, for instance, in Washington County with the site where we had to completely move all the land, all the fill that went into that, to that, what do we call them again, a solid waste facility, that we had to move, line it, triple line it, move it back over, and a very, very good project, very important, the kind of thing we should be doing. And I know we use bonding, we use some fees paid by some of the folks that deposited there. You talked about insurance recovery money and such, but what other things? I hear a lot of new and things that all led to the yellow garbage can getting more in it than the green garbage can. So when you dive into it, I think we need to see how are those priorities, where the $17 million of general fund is important that we look at that. I don't want us to only concentrate on $17 million when the budget is hundreds of millions. Are we spending the money correctly? Are we doing the right thing as we work our way through these issues? Is there any other questions while the commissioner's here? Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair McNamara, and Commissioner. Thank you for coming today. I'm stretching back a ways in my memory before being elected in 2002. But in a couple of my communities up in the Northeast, we had places where over my lifetime, we basically backed up and threw all our garbage over the side of a hill. And it was a giant, it was the best bear park in the whole Northeast Minnesota and the Crane Lake. It was fabulous. I mean, people drove out there and spent hours watching the bears. Along came where we built in our community these line landfill, managed right next to it, as a matter of fact, within 100 feet or so. Then, at that time when that was built, the county put a clay cover over the top of the landfill, which we created, our community created, and it basically didn't exist. It was just gone, covered. And then a few years later, it was decided, St. Louis County decided they were going to take all the garbage that was put in the landfill that was lined and transfer it to Virginia, and thousands of truckloads went down there. And I can't remember what happened to the landfill that didn't exist, the one that my generation and generations before me threw all the stuff over the hill, mattresses and garbage and trucks and cars and furniture and every imaginable thing went over there. I'm sure plenty of hazardous waste, old batteries. Are there a lot of those around the state still? Because, you know, I go there and it's still landscaped because we have a canister site there now that gets transferred. It's still landscaped, growing beautiful grass, beautiful side of a slope of a hill, but I don't remember if that garbage is under there. So when we're talking closed landfill program, could you help me out there with that? What's really going on there?
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, I don't have the specifics today, but we can get back to you on the landfills that are in the program, and at least an estimate if we've got the information of these other landfills that are out there that haven't necessarily been part of the program. I suspect the one you're talking about is not. I don't know that for sure, but I will double check on that. You raise a great point. Whether you call it solid waste or garbage, I mean, we generate a lot, and it's it gets moved around, and it's one of those foundational pieces of activity that the counties take on, cities take on, the state takes on all the time that we don't really pay that much attention to until we start to run out of space in a given solid waste facility. So we'll come back to you on that one. I'll be curious to find out the fate of your bear park.
Follow up, Representative Dill.
I just wanted to say that I'm not being critical of
no.
it. I'm just
no.
wondered how many of those
yeah.
exist, because I thought it was odd. I was the city administrator in Orr at the time, and mm-hmm. I said, well, what are we going to do with all this stuff? Well, when we put, because it's before the rules were adopted, as I remember, we could put the clay cover on and it doesn't really exist.
Right.
But yeah, I'm thinking of all the batteries and, mm-hmm. you know, flashlight batteries and all the things that we worry about today, whatever happened. And I wonder if that's common in a lot of those communities like that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
Yeah, I think I did, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I was listening to your story, Representative Deal, and it was interesting. Ms. Halbach,
you don't have anything like that out in Glenwood, right?
No. Nothing we want to talk about anyway.
Representative Anderson.
Ms. Halbach, you mentioned the SCORE funding, and I know counties, at least my county, appreciates getting that that money from the state. Is that funding stable, going up or down, or what's happening with the SCORE grants to counties?
Ms. Halbach, and members, I'm trying to give some latitude here, and I think it's a great question, and one I am glad you asked, Representative Anderson. Some of these, I think it's important for the commissioner to hear some of the areas, and I know you're going to get into it more, Ms. Halbach, but SCORE grants, counties, up or down?
Mr. Chair, in this budget, they are flat. The SCORE, over the life of the history of the SCORE funds, they've been up and down. And they certainly have not progressed at the level that you might think inflation or where they are. So we are continuing to have conversations with the counties on what's the level and how to do that. One of the conversations that I had with them just in December was about finishing, again, that closed landfill program that takes a good share of the environmental fund over there, which gives us, again, more flexibility. But in the budget as you see it now, it is still, we're putting out $14.25 million to it. Back in 2000, it was about $12 million, and we've been trying to creep it back up because it was really at $12 million for quite a while. It hasn't changed.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as long as we're on landfills, I was not going to ask this question, but I am now. are there moving targets? I've had conversations with the Marquette landfill up in our area, and they have a process to me that sounds somewhat complicated where they collect the water at the bottom of the landfill. It's called leachate, I believe, and then they move that to a settling pond, and then they have an irrigation system set up on some ground that has reed canary grass growing on it. And help me out here a little bit, please, but there's one particular substance in that they're looking for that's going into the soil, and now because they're in violation of, can you help me out with that? I'm just curious to know about moving targets for these area landfills.
Hey, Commissioner, Ms. Halbach, is this something off the top of your head, or we can do phone a friend tomorrow?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be better if we came back to you on that. In terms of moving targets, you know, over time, the concerns about leachate and what's in the leachate has definitely changed. And it's changed for a couple of reasons. One is that the type of construction of the landfills and how much water they allow to move through or not. And the other is the materials that are actually in there. As Representative Dill talked about, it's a far different scenario when you have car batteries that were put in a landfill than it is now, where those car batteries are at least attempted to be kept out. So a moving target, maybe a moving target, or maybe different concerns, depending on the time and generation of the landfill itself. But we can come back to you.
Ms. Halbach, I apologize. The phone a friend comment is you can get some additional resources from friends that you may know back in the agency. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill brought up a real issue that we actually started to deal with maybe 15 years ago, because the landfills and the landfill cleanup program are only permitted landfills, and you were talking about an unpermitted landfill. And if I remember correctly, there were about 1,500 of them that people thought we really needed to deal with, but then the momentum to do that stopped about 15 years ago. But there are a lot around the state. They're just like that. So that's a fascinating question and another problem for you guys.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Just one quick comment, if I may. And your discussion of how we use solid waste dollars that are collected. And I just wanted you to be aware, I'm not sure how your county operates, but we have what we call a roof tax out in rural Minnesota, at least in the counties up in my way. It's a solid waste tax that's put on based on the roof, the building. And then that goes into the process, and we can take our solid waste to a transfer station. Yeah, and we don't have to pay for ordinary solid waste going to that because we pay that roof tax. So there's a little bit different methodology. If you take in something that's hazardous or whatever, then you're going to pay a couple extra bucks. But I'm sure Representative Hancock knows exactly what I'm talking about. I don't know how many rural counties do that, but I don't know if we come out ahead or not, but that's the way we're doing it.
Well, Representative Purcell, I can't say how it works in my household. My wife pays the bills, but I just know on Tuesday mornings I got to put two garbage cans out every other Tuesday and one on one Tuesday, and the one I can barely get all the stuff in, and it's twice as big as the other one. So I just know a lot goes to the recycling. Two different trucks come by, and I think they go to Pine Bend, the landfill I drive by on my way to work, and unfortunately a lot of this is learning experience for me. Commissioner, I think we might have one more question. Or follow-up, Representative Purcell.
I'm sorry. You're a brave man for admitting domestic circumstances.
And I've been in trouble, Representative Purcell. She's been in Mexico for 11 days, so the bills are piling up. They're not getting paid. And I hope I'm not going to jail. No, just kidding. Luckily, most of them are automatic pay. Representative Dill, last question for the commissioner.
Thank you. On a different track, on-site septic systems are not on-site, I'm sorry, permitted municipal systems that are trickling sand filters. We have had in the bonding bill, as I recall, money to remediate the problem with some kind of a design that failed in communities. It was a couple of million in the last bonding bill, as I remember. Communities got their systems designed. We have one in my community, a trickling sand filter. It's working. But others have failed, and we've been bonding because the communities have already borrowed and spent all the money and taxed the people and are collecting the fees, but in order to replace that, we had to help them with bonding money. Do you know how many more of those there are, and what kind of backlog we're going to be looking at in helping communities equally to recover from these failures?
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner.
I don't have that number handy. We can obviously get it to you. I don't know if Myrna's got that one in her head.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Dill.
Well, I mean, I'm not as up to date on that. Maybe as Representative Wagenius, she may remember how much we put in aggregate into mm-hmm. the bonding bill thus far. It was a fair amount, as I remember. And I just wondered, I mean, are we just like covered up with this problem, or are we seeing the end of the tunnel on this? And you know, people can only sustain so much monthly fee. And I have one organization, one community, and on the North Shore that their monthly fee for their sewer treatment system is $175 a month in North Shore Sanitary District. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is a critical issue regardless of how much it is, but if we have a huge backlog of that, we should know it as a committee.
Mr. Chair, we'll come back to you on that.
Thank you. Commissioner, I appreciate you being here and staying for some of the, so you get kind of a feel for some of the questions that are going to come over the next 2 days. Ms. Hallbeck, if you want to begin.
Mr. Chair, members, first you should have three different documents. One is a two-page handout that'll come in handy, I think, as we do the budget. It's a brief summary of the initiatives and the budget. So I just made that, and it's one you can carry around for you to do. One is a longer, and I had thought I would do the spreadsheet-like format first today, because I think it sets up even more questions for us tomorrow as we go through the budget, and then I will also bring back to you some of the dollars and cents questions that we had this morning, because I think the solid waste tax, the environmental fund, some of those questions will work better tomorrow as we actually talk about the whole.
Ms. Hallbeck, sounds like a good plan. Proceed.
Two years ago, the agency worked with this committee to try to develop what we called performance measures and broke our budget into the various areas of the strategic plan, trying to really think about what were our outcomes, how to absolutely answer the question the chair has asked about where does the money go and how to do it. The sheet before you is a combination of that which we thought we were doing last year and then updates on those metrics, and a little bit continuing forward with what we achieved during the fiscal year 10 and 11 biennium and where we see some of the things going in 12 and 13. I do not have as formal a presentation for my 12 and 13 budget for a number of reasons, and primarily it is because we are in a state of flux right now. And part of that is what will we decide in how we manage the hole in the environmental fund. We have a number of early retirements that are coming that will implicate where our staffing will be. And then sometime I think this month we'll find out whether the federal government will be reducing our part of that. And so we, with that and the fact that the agency went to a business plan and has some focus areas where we're going to be shifting priorities of staff, we have our programs reevaluating exactly where they're going to have the people. So I do intend to have a very similar document like this by July 1, if not before that, but it really is, we need a little bit of settling with it. We also, at the end of the calendar year, knowing we were going to get a new commissioner, didn't want to set too many things in stone till I have the ability to talk with the commissioner where exactly in the budget is. But I want to talk to you about this. I want to talk generally where we are with the budget, where we're putting efforts, answer the questions about how we're managing FTEs, what we've been doing along the way, and certainly answer questions because I think that will inform the final document. You will see when we walk through this a number of areas that in the past 2 years we have reduced or stopped doing. That was a considered effort on our part in order to balance the budget and to move staff to higher priority. So I also tried to highlight that in these areas. So with that, I'll just try to walk us through the spreadsheet-like document and answer questions as we move along and come back tomorrow, I think, and really spend the time on the money and where we are both for 10 and 11. To do. So if we just start on page 2 of your document. The vision is our first vision, which is Minnesota's take responsibility. And these are what we call our goals. And this would be the area where we really work with institutions and individuals to try to increase the recycling, reduce stormwater impacts, and to do. We've had to relook at how these really exist as separate goals, and in the future you'll see them wrapped really into the areas that they support. So our air toxics watershed work, where they will actually be helping and using assistance methods to bring our impaired waters into compliance or actually protect the waters from going out of it. So if you'll see that on the objective one, where we were looking at green building assistance, we have been participating both with cities and the University of Minnesota to actually look at what can you do to help your buildings be green, both from an energy point of view, how you manage the waste in construction of it, and putting on presentations. That area will be on a decline for us only because we need to really use the staffing and the skills that help create these calculators for carbon and the greenhouse gas. They're working with what we call the Green Step Cities to create a number of calculators for when the cities put in rain gardens, when they reforest their urban area. What does that actually do from runoff from the land into stormwater? What does it actually do for the carbon reduction greenhouse gas areas to do? And what can they use in that to show compliance with a permit in matching BMPs? the goal is if we can generate those calculators enough, we want to relook at where the permits are and see if we can't have cities at a certain tiered level be able to move out of the permits because they have compliance and they have the activities in a voluntary method. Very similar to where our small business assistance program works with industries to figure out how they can reduce air emissions so they don't need air permits, so that they can take their materials and not store them outside in the rain so they don't need a stormwater permit. The goal is really just compliance on the environmental issues and not necessarily a permit. That is what we're trying to do. That is what this focus was. And we really had people interested in doing the training. We've had local government entities do it. We work very closely with the University of Minnesota and their energy resource teams. We're watching television last night. They had some of them on, helping insulate and helping folks reduce their energy to do. We've done what we call smart modeling, remodeling workshops, where we really work with the builders, and we've had a strong interest with the builders to look at this. This is both how they reduce the waste that on the site, how they create a better environment in the remodel job that they're doing. And now we've had 65 of them who are willing to stay in touch with us and let us know how this works on an ongoing basis. Because they have to put it into action. We don't. And we want to know whether that really works or not to do. You'll see in the has waste area, household has waste, one of our goals is actually to increase the attendance, and I'll have a slide tomorrow for us on that and show you how much money we invest into it. But the counties really needed kind of a marketing tool in the new media where we Twitter and we Facebook and we use our websites to communicate with people in a way different world. That's what our communication staff and our experts in the household has waste did. And now those communities are using that to expand their participation. If we expand participation at a long enough area, we should see the amount of household has waste go down because we'll also choose better and wise on not having the chemicals in the first place.
Ms. Hallbeck, EACM, an acronym, has been used the last couple times. What it is and where it comes from?
Good question, Mr. Chair. EACM is an appropriation that we get, and it is an environmental assistance in cross media. So part of that was the originally funded work that came to us from the Office of Environmental Assistance when they merged with us. Now 5 years ago, and part of it is what we used to have as multimedia, so those sorts of work that cross over between water, air, and land. Think of environmental review that actually addresses all the air, water, land. We fund them out of cross media. Environmental assistance is often you're working on one area and you're having an impact on the other, and that's actually much of our work is if you take something out of the water, are you then burning it or land spreading it, and what is the risk add to it? So it is an appropriation that we get from this committee, both in the environmental fund and in the general fund.
Thank you, Ms. Hallbeck. Continue.
You'll see at the bottom of page 3 that we have a goal by January 1 of 2013 to increase the purchase of environmentally preferred products, and this is working with the Department of Administration, which actually does do most of the purchasing contract work for the state agencies, and local counties are able to purchase through that cooperative agreement as well. And so we do a lot of work with them on what kinds of products we can put on there that give people choices. And we want to increase that working with the Department of Administration. And most of that will be tracked actually in the dollars, in the way we spend the dollars. So you can see our goal was some 300 some million dollars between all counties and state government in that, and we're actually on track to do that. So when we're all purchasing, that we're purchasing environmentally safe products. Goal R2 is when we're actually working with businesses on their green products and their green services to do it, and we're trying to reduce the problem materials. You might have thought as your television way back when was a problem material. Those started often being pulled out because they had other resources to them. And so in the past, we've worked on lead tackle. You know that lead in the environment can cause problems both for not only humans, but actually wildlife. We've ended that program. We consider it a success in that it's really out in the marketplace now and it doesn't need the government to help push it along any further. The other program that we consider a success was our mercury-free schools, where we, some members here might remember, we had Clancy the sniffing dog who could sniff out mercury spills and hazards in schools, and then we helped the schools replace that mercury and clean up the mercury with the money. So that is where some of the environmental dollars went in the past. We removed the hazards. Much like a bomb-sniffing dog, Clancy was able to sniff mercury. And he has since retired, and the program is completed to do. Then in one of the other large areas is mercury switches. They're very sustainable and long-lasting, but you have to dispose of it the right way or you release the mercury into the environment. So we continue to work with salvage yards on that. And then more recently, because of the e-waste legislation, we're working with folks to collect electronic waste and to manage that.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good that you retired since we're promoting CFLs and putting mercury back in our schools instead of going with better technology. What is the percentage of recycling that we're doing with the CFLs?
Ms. Hallbeck, if you don't have that off the top of your head, we can bring that back tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwong, if we move to page 5 at the top of it, on the state fiscal year, you'll see some numbers there where we were for the CFLs. We have the basic poundage number, but I do not have the percentage of all of that in the waste stream, so we'll have to go back and get that.
Mr. Chair. Originally, when these came out, you saw it good for 5 years or 3 years, and from personal experience, it doesn't seem as if they last as long. Maybe that's because of Minnesota not being the optimum environment for this technology. And looking at some of the estimates, were they based upon what years of life were they based upon?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwong, I'd have to go back into our staff that researched that for quite some time. I don't have that off the top of my head.
Representative Kwong and Ms. Hallbeck, I believe the staff to your right is fervishly, is it? What's the right word there? We don't have Representative Erickson here to help me with my English, and my sister Vicky's not here, so Kirk, you're writing it down, I hope, Representative Qualm's question. I forgot, Representative Fabian was a teacher, too, so he'll have to help me out. Fayed, but you probably know English better than I. We're back on track?
Yeah.
Yep. Thank you. Continue, Ms. Hallbeck.
Staying on page 5, then, you'll see in Objective 2B, where we were, we used to work with cities on sustainable industrial manufacturing. And while we have a portion of a person who still does that, as cities call him, is not actively out working with industrial development and cities in doing this. We had to redeploy the staff in this area to work both on the solid waste centroid, and we'll talk more about that in a little while and tomorrow. We also use the skills of these people in our ethanol compliance work and assistance that we were just recently completed. And then moving the Green Step cities, which we really think has the potential to be very beneficial across the state. So that's an area that we have reduced our work in. Then if you pop to the bottom of this, where we were trying to do particular technical assistance, this is really where we engage the University of Minnesota in their technical assistance program, where they use a number of interns to work directly with businesses and reduce the waste and save money for the businesses. And the reason we use this, you'll hear the term MNTAP for that, and the reason we do that is those businesses are able to keep confidential then their inner workings of the business, and they're not required that we as a public agency, and that was set up in statute that way.
Ms. Hallbeck, clarification, and Representative Scott has a question. So the reason for using the U of M was to protect data privacy concerns of the business? Did I get that right?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you, Ms. Hallbeck. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had a question going back to R2B. Staff are redeployed to do solid waste, centroid work, ethanol, and so forth. And I'm just wondering what the outcome of that redeployment of staff was. What numbers can you offer us the successes that were gained there?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, the Green Step Cities is taking off. I think we're nearly 200 cities that are now starting to input data into the database on their activities, which include what are they doing with rain gardens, what are they doing for energy within their facilities, how are they managing the best management practices under their stormwater permit, and it has a number of other areas that it is growing into. The ethanol compliance and assistance, we have stopped a formal, we had a year-long process where we engaged the ethanol companies themselves because, as I think many here have seen in the last few years, this new industry was having some compliance issues both with its water and its air. And we really wanted to understand. It's not too much different than back in the 70s when we converted to straight pipes and we started operating wastewater treatment plants. We had compliance issues. You have to learn what the process is, how to manage that and do it. People often will not get their paperwork done. We've seen, and the truth of that will be the next couple of years, whether they can stay in compliance. We've been working with them. But we certainly are engaged, and they are understand their permits better, understand the expectations of them, and timing of submittals for their permits. The solid waste centroid, I'm going to have some statistics on that a little bit later, but we're having 70% of the waste is actually generated in four parts of the state: the metro area, the St. Cloud area, the Rochester area, and the Duluth area. And so we're really focusing, if we can focus in those areas to get composting, waste reduction, and recycling, we can do a good share to reduce the waste that is either landfilled or buried. That's the goal, and those are the areas, and the communities have again engaged with us on how to appropriate do that. We have some grants going out. Elk River has a grant that they believe will actually save the city money by doing source-separated organics. And they have some real metrics to increase that level to do. Duluth has been working with us and the Western Lake Sanitary District to do that. So it'll take another year or so for those grants to come to completion to get the real results of them. But the goals of them I do have in here later to do.
Thank you. Continue, Ms. Hallbeck.
So a couple of brief areas then under R2C where you will see that money saved by those businesses working with MNTAP were $3.1 million and $4.36 million in 2009. Calendar year, we look at these on a calendar year, not on a state year, so those reports are just coming in the calendar year. We anticipate it'll be roughly in the same. our small businesses have been able to reduce hazardous air pollutants and in some cases actually help the business avoid needing a permit or reduce the type of permit they've needed. But we will be, for calendar year 2010, by the end of the current fiscal year, be able to report on water use, energy use, and wastewater. And if you look on page 6, in about the middle column, you'll see the historical numbers we've been able to achieve. And we expect that same sort of result to happen. And it really does work out better for the industries. They've been able to reuse products within their industry, so they're manufacturing less waste. They've been able to conserve a lot of water. In some cases, one company saved significant amounts of water and also saved the energy needed to warm it up. We just get the preliminary kinds of numbers and some very schematics about it, again, so that we're not into the process of the manufacturer. It really was set up to help this. And the industries then are able to talk more freely with the university, and the university brings together the interns and its engineering specialties. So it really is a good marriage of results. I will tell you, as we put through our industrial stormwater permit last year, we were able, with our small business assistance staff, help over 1,000 of those avoid needing the permit and get what's called a no exposure, which means their materials aren't exposed to rainfall and won't run off. The goal really would be to help all businesses not need that industrial stormwater. That's probably not reality, but the more we can work with them and the more they understand where they can store materials and how to manage it is really what our small business assistance program does. And again, they're not connected with our regulatory side of the agency, so that they're free to help people.
Ms. Hallbeck, if I could accentuate that, that seems like a really good thing you're doing. You talked about how you help them work through the process. Were you able to meet all the demand of businesses that wanted help in this area that actually went to your agency looking for help as opposed to the agency looking for them?
Mr. Chair, members, we met the demand. I can't tell you how timely it was and whether those who really wanted our services all came to us. But we were able, the staff does track how many calls they do, and they're very timely in their responses. I sent a question 2 weeks ago to them to help a hazardous waste, and they answered it within hours. Okay. And so they do try to be very timely with the responses.
Ms. Hallbeck, if you could, in your list of, again, if I'm just curious to if you could check in with those folks and see if they're, if they think it's an opportunity where we could actually grow assistance for folks and make things work more streamlined. Thank you. Please continue.
Then on the bottom of page 7, here's an area, again, that we eliminated due to budget reductions in the environmental assistance and educational area. We ended the work of the Environmental Education Task Force, and we redeployed that staff to TMDLs. Working in the TMDL world requires you to have both good communication skills and a broad base of assistance along with the science and the efforts that you have. And so these staff have brought together some new skills into our TMDL, where we had the technical scientists, and we still have the technical scientists, but how do you bring that and help engage the locals so that they understand the TMDL and that they have the ability to implement actually what the TMDL requires? The folks that came from here had not only the science background, but had furthered their training in the education and outreach and those sorts, and are project managers now in our TMDL area. Unfortunately, one of them didn't match up, and we did lay one of the folks off. But this is an area we had to reduce in order to manage the budget and our priorities. One of the areas that tuned with the educational task force and the other is what's called the SEEK website, which is for education educators, and they share a number of information. We still support the website for it, but we're not actively producing. That way the educators can still find information and still have a way to connect and do it. But we're not actively generating educational curriculum for schools. We've asked periodically with the Department of Education whether they need us. The authority actually lies with the Department of Natural Resources in this area. And so we help manage the website, but we don't have any activity in the area. On the bottom of page 9, you'll see both in our environmental, generally, we try to use volunteers to engage. And, of course, that is one of the goals under the Clean Water Legacy Act, is that we utilize volunteers to the extent we have. We actually challenge ourselves to try to use volunteers and bring them in. One of the areas we did on a regular basis that we no longer do was the Living Green Expo. In the spring of 2010, we actually let that go to an environmental group that was able to pick it up. So again, it was in a place that could go and move on and have someone else do it after the energy was there. We think Green Core, which I'll talk more about, is an opportunity really for us to engage more local citizens in it, along with those who already do stream monitoring, lake monitoring with us. And that Green Core is really working in a community with a college student who is able to meet the needs of that community. Again, it's not us telling them, they actually apply, ask for a student. They have needs maybe in the schools, and I'll have some of the numbers for us, to help recycling in the schools, maybe composting, energy recycling. We've worked with some communities to actually inventory all their forests, their urban forest, and look at whether they've got invasive species coming into that. And we partner with the Department of Natural Resources on that. We partner with the Department of Ag on community gardens and what that does in the area. And then we also partner with the Department of Health on some of the indoor air issues that we can do. So we're kind of managing the people in the grant. This has been a 2-year grant, and we've applied for a 3-year grant. We have 18 people out at 20 sites. The University of Minnesota Morris does this in the West Central, and so we partner with them, and it really gives the community what it needs. We're not dictating to them. They come forward and say, we would like this kind of project, need this kind of help. The student works there for a year, gets an educational stipend, and then turns around and has actual achievements back out there. Again, under R3C, with the first one, we were looking to give small business loans. We have a small amount of money to help small businesses look at auxiliary power units. This is so that they don't have to use diesel. Both has an air emission thing, but it saves them money. And particularly with the cost of fuel right now, it saves them significant. The economy had them not using this loan program, but another program that I'll talk to you under the air, where we had 4 different funding opportunities to retrofit engines and diesel, both the buses, fire trucks. We've done whole fleets for folks, and we're saving them money, but also reducing energy needs by them and diesel. So we had a goal to give out 25 loans. We've only done 5 under this program to do. And again, I talked about the Living Green, that we ended working and moving those 4 FTEs to help in other areas. So now, Mr. Chair, members, we're approaching our last one, which is really about...
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, I continually hear where you've reallocated and moved FTE. The numbers that we have in the spreadsheet, are they the actual FTE? Because if you've moved them, then obviously this wouldn't be actual. So do you have something that shows what you had and what you've allocated?
Ms. Hallbeck?
Mr. Chair, not as straightforward as that, but I will have numbers for you that reference exactly where the increased growth is and where the reductions are. That will be part of the discussion tomorrow.
Thank you, Ms. Hallbeck. Continue. I'm sorry, Representative Anderson, sorry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, you mentioned the small business loan program to convert diesel engines. To what are they being converted into?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, members, there are different types of auxiliary powers, so depending on whether it's an engine or whether it's their actual business they have, but many of them may run on a different source, and some of them are actually electric. But they don't use as much energy. And in some cases, if you have, so this will get close to beyond my knowledge of the AIR program, but when you're permitted as a business in AIR, if you have an auxiliary power that's diesel, you have to account for how that might influence. So if you can move to an electric one, which doesn't generate an emission right at your source, it will change what your permit is after. So there's a couple reasons they're doing them. What to do?
Ms. You're probably thinking the same thing I am. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. But, well, I think fire trucks were mentioned. What particularly would they be converted to?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, members, fire trucks weren't with the auxiliary power. They were actually, their catalytic converters were changed.
Ms. Hallbeck, are we dealing with where a business has auxiliary, back to the auxiliary power, they have auxiliary power units as a backup if they lose their, because they may be in a business where they, by having auxiliary power backup, they're able to keep the shifts going and such. But if that auxiliary power is diesel, you need them to take into account that air emissions from that into their overall permit. And by switching to propane or kerosene, or probably not kerosene, but propane or it wouldn't be electric. I'm assuming they're losing their electric. Switching to something else, it lowers their potential air emissions, so it keeps them in compliance. Is that what we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, you are correct.
Thank you. Representative Scott, did I miss you or did you get to speak? Thank you. Continue, Ms. Hallbeck.
Okay, so let me move to, again, we were on the agency's environmental footprint on page 11. This gets to a little bit both how the agency represents itself as an environmental agency, but also in our efficiencies and how we manage. And so one of the ways that we do this is by reducing the paper we use and move to electronic systems. And so alone we have reduced the paper by person, so you can know that it doesn't matter whether we just stop buying paper, which I did reduce so much. But the generation on average is 10,000 sheets of paper a year per person. And we're down in the neighborhood of 4,000. The goal is to be paperless. I don't know if I'll achieve it, but that's the goal. Along with that same thing is we reduced our fleet mileage by using the new term telepresence. Most of us would think of it as video conferencing. But we have really reduced the number of meetings we go to between our regional offices in St. Paul, between some of our partners, which is actually more convenient for them. So the folks that are in War Road get their training actually from us in St. Paul by just linking on to us rather than having to meet with us. And we're doing that more regularly all the time. And it's turning out I'm reducing our fleet regularly. I just approved another 5 cars to be removed from our fleet each car is about $6,000 a year. It doesn't on an individual basis turn out, but as you continue to do this over the years, you save money and you save fuel. So that's the sort of thing that we're doing. We also worked with our landlord in St. Paul, because we lease it, we don't own it, to reduce the energy to do, and we did reduce it by 12%, both in gas and the electric we use, and it saved our landlord over $15,000, of which then he invested back into improving some of his windows and recaulking and sharing some of that with us in fixing and improving our compost areas. So it's a mutual that goes on a regular basis, but it's mutually to our benefits to reduce the cost. I will ultimately pay less in rent. The landlord will ultimately pay less to use his building, and it'll save money for everyone.
Ms. Hallbeck, I want to commend you for your statement right there. You said, I will pay less in rent, and I want to commend you for this is our money, and I'm glad you have that attitude of that when you're saving money, it's you saving money. It's not the state of Minnesota. So thank you. Please continue.
Secondly, at the last on that page, you will see that we have been trying to figure out how to use our closed landfills in a different manner. It takes some time before you can actually say that it's free open park space and you don't have to worry about gas being generated or the leachate. So we have a grant out right now, and we're in negotiations to use a landfill near the city of Olmsted to use solar panels and actually collect energy and then put it back on the grid. We again would be able to share in the resource of that, help funding the O&M for the landfill into the future. We've analyzed 13 other landfills for the opportunity to use maybe wind generation on them, and again have a public-private partnership that we recoup some of the costs that it takes to operate the gas ventilation system, the leachate collection systems at those landfills, and share that cost in a very cooperative way rather than moving the environmental fund over to pay for it. So we continue to explore those types of uses for the land. The land is in our hands for at least another 40 years, and we think we should make some production out of it. The other thing, we tend to be in our work a catalyst for many folks to save energy and reduce greenhouse gases. And per the executive order that was issued last year, we have a sustainability plan, which really looks at then what's our energy level, what's our fuel level, what's our gas. And we use to go out helping other communities retired engineers. So again, for a small $5,000 from us, a retired engineer will go work at the school and improve their energy cost, and again, save at the school level, and we get the environmental benefit of it.
Thank you. Representative Purcell had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallbeck, if I go back just a little ways here, on the building, and it looks like here you're referencing the St. Paul building. Just curious, what you mentioned that the owner's putting, you know, money, when you save money, putting it back into some green items. What's happened with the lease rates over the past decade? I know you've been doing this for a while. Do you have any, you know, anything on top of your head on that?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, I've only been in this job for 3 years, though, but we're making improvements. The current lease at the St. Paul building has been in place and runs till 2013. But we have initiated right now discussions with the landlord on that very topic, on what's the rental we're paying and what are we going to achieve. We're also looking, again, as we shrink in size and I'm moving paper out of the building, can I lease less floor space? and can I use that floor space in a bedroom? I'm doing some analysis right now, but I might be able to use one less floor, for instance. So we rent an entire six-floor building here in St. Paul. I'd like to shrink that. Telecommuting will help us, but also just spacing ourselves the right way.
Representative Purcell, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that landlord local? Do you know?
I couldn't resist, but I'm glad Representative Purcell, I did resist, I should say. Director Hallbeck, to the who owns your building?
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, a Japanese firm owns the building.
Thank you.
Along that same line, may I...
Director Hallbeck, continue.
Just give ourselves a little credit for... we are opening up the leases on our seven regional offices as well to look at those leases. We just moved our Marshall office into shared building with the Lyon County Public Works and reduced sized and worked out there where they had space not being used. So we are looking at the footprint of our space and then also the leases on what we're doing.
Director Hallbeck, I would strongly encourage you to do the negotiating for those leased and not delegate to someone above or below you. Continue, Director Hallbeck.
I talked about, let's see, the bottom of page 12, climate change core, you'll see we have a penchant for acronyms and fancy names in our agency, and so you wouldn't be surprised when we use ECHM till we have climate change core. This we did not get off the ground. This was an area that we thought we were going to be able to use, again, more retired experts, but you can only manage so many small groups of people. And so we're really working with the retired engineers. That's been very successful. We're working with the university and their energy core. And now we have the Green Core members, which are really the young and coming and looking at our future. So we really didn't do much with the climate core. This is an area, again, where it would have taken a little bit of money and someone just to organize it. But when you take pieces of people, they're not always as efficient. So we elected not to do this one. Okay. On page 13, we're moving into what would be our standard kind of media visions. Again, as we work through these, out came the need really for us to look at the air focus and the watershed. And I think it'll become clear to you why we want to focus on it and where, again, we might be, as we are talking right now, needing to move resources to those areas to keep up with the demand. Originally, we thought we were going to have a number of biofuels and those sorts of environmental reviews continuing in fiscal year 10 and 11. 7, 8, 9 had been very productive in the ethanol world, and that pretty much dropped off with the recession. So again, we had environmental review, but we didn't have them in the big projects we did. Feedlots still maintained to be one of our primary areas of environmental review. And we had some small wastewater, landfills, and energy source. But those don't tend to have as much in the air area as we do with ethanol or a big power plant or mining, per se. You heard Commissioner Austin talk earlier about our concern about staying in attainment. So for fiscal year 12 and 13, we have really made air toxics and that attainment and where those rules are a focus for the agency. We are developing currently plans on how we're going to approach rules so that businesses can actually meet those rules, how we can take proactive measures to reduce the emissions, because it's not a point source issue that it's going to be just on. Mobile sources are part of the PM 2.5. That's why we've been working on diesel. We need to continue to work on those sorts of issues with business and with the average citizen in doing what we can to reduce it. So we're looking at particulate matter ozone. We want to expand those partnerships. We have a current non-attainment right now for lead, as you'll see down in the Gopher Resources, and they've implemented, and they're getting below that lead standard for air, but they'll have to stay there for 3 years to come back in an attainment and not follow the very strict permit rules air quality requires of them. And so that is the sort of thing that we'd have to do in the metro area if we become non-attainment. We'd have to watch everybody. Serious record keeping. If you were going to be doing reopening your permit and doing something, you have additional modeling to do, which is very expensive modeling, and you really then have to show the best technology to meet them. So all of this ratchets up the same cost of doing business when we're in attainment. Again, prevention is much cheaper than retrofitting, and that's what we've been working on.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Hallbeck. I'm glad you're working on the prevention on the fine particulate matter. Makes total sense to me. But I go back to your saying that your climate change core was not implemented. So my question is, if you were to reduce the climate change gases, it seems to me you would be also reducing fine particulate in ozone. So how much would it have cost, or how much would it cost to manage a climate change core with the notion that as they reduce climate change gases, they would be also reducing fine particulates in ozone?
Director Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I don't have the number right offhand, but it takes about a half an FTE to manage the to work with MNTAP and the retired engineers. It takes about 1.5 FTEs to manage the 30 folks that are in the Green Corps folks. So that'll give you a range. We pay a very small stipend in each of those cases, less than $12,000 in a year to do. We are trying to look at, are there ways to fund this in a very unique way? We've had schools offer to help pay in a different manner in some of the businesses. So that would be the closest I'd have the exact for an exact number.
Follow up, Representative Wagenius.
Okay, so we know the cost is on the small range. Now let's talk about if we were to reduce climate change gases significantly with this core. Is my premise correct that if we did some good targeting, we would also be reducing fine particulate matter in ozone?
Director Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, when you're reducing any of those, yes, you do reduce ozone and you reduce particulate matter. I wouldn't know. You know, I'm not an air expert, so I don't know the exact level of it. But that is why we use some of the folks that were in the assistance areas to work in our solid waste centroid, because if we can reduce that as well, that we found in the climate change study that solid waste is one of our biggest opportunities. So doing that in our mobile vehicles, I think we have lots of opportunities.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, since none of us want us to get in, I mean, I'm sure that that is a something that both sides of the table would do not want us to get into non-attainment. It seems to me that having this climate change core would be an extremely cost-effective way of helping
keep us entertained.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hallbach. I don't know, we've been here and gone through about 13 pages or so, and I look at the different goals of the agencies. The first vision is Minnesotans take responsibility to protect our environment. We get to page 13 on the bottom, and we're starting to get into the part that I understand to be the role of the agency, and that is one of permitting and environmental review and those things that I understand the agency is supposed to be doing and directed by law to do. Page 13 on the bottom, and you outlined the amount of EAW and EIS work has reduced, has been reduced with the recession, and so I would expect you've had less work for those people to do, and then I'm seeing coupled with that these other areas of work that or activity I should say that we are out there creating climate change cores, and the commissioner testified in an earlier hearing. He didn't know exactly how climate was going to change, and so I don't know exactly what we're doing with some of these things. Greenhouse gas emissions. We're trying to engineer people's behavior and businesses' behavior around alternative power units that we still don't know exactly what those are. Are we going to get to what the priorities of the agencies are? The agency is, and the other question would be, where does the agency get its authority to commit to activity in these other areas?
Director Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we actually have fairly broad requirements, and particularly when we were merged with the Office of Environmental Assistance, protection and reduction of emissions is as important as permitting, compliance, and enforcement. And in fact, we usually try to associate assistance and the compliance as the better way to overall manage the facilities that we're required to regulate. So it is a combination of authorities, but the Solid Waste Act that we have responsibility to do looks at the hierarchy of waste management, which is reduce, reuse, recycle, then try to use capture the energy sources either through composting or incineration, and then landfill as the least resort. Many of the other things that we're due with this work is to actually eliminate those kinds of waste products. So we're one of the folks who understands the implications that if you have a hazardous waste in your process and you're going to dispose of it or have someone pick it up, it's going to cost you more than if you can produce and work and have a non-hazardous waste part of your system. So we don't see them as separate. We see them formulated. We do understand that one of, our major priority is permitting, compliance, and the regulatory side. But we also have statutory authority on the assistance side, too.
Representative Drazkowski, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Hallbach. So, Ms. Hallbach, as we're going into classrooms and talking to kids, apparently, about greenhouse gases and climate change, which we really don't know how climate's going to change, and we're working with businesses to engineer the future of their behavior, are those types of activities specifically authorized by your agency in statute, or is that rule that you've developed that have allowed you to do these things that I think many Minnesotans would wonder what we're doing here? Can you tell us a little more about where that authority comes from specifically?
Director Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have the statute on hand, but it is not a rule. There are statutes, and we try to be creative as we go about it. but you can see that we take the priorities in the permitting, environmental review, and compliance as one of our primary jobs to do, and that is why you've seen the shift from the education. There's actually a statute that sets up the educational task force. We're to work with the Department of Natural Resources on it. So how we go about it and how we try is how we would reach out and manage. So in the current world, if you're going to try to reach young people, you'd tweet, or you might use Facebook. They also have a couple others. And so we're part of this system is not to just to stay at the current, it's to look at those coming and look at those who've gone before us, and how do we manage a system.
Follow-up, Representative Jaskowski.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you, Ms. Halbach. I'm just curious, Ms. Halbach, would your agency be able to provide for us an outline of those statutes and or rules that provide your authority in at least the first 13 pages in each of those creative interpretation activities that are included there, and maybe some of the other areas that might be considered non-traditional MPCA activities beyond the permitting and environmental review, things that I think most of us understand to be at the core of what you're supposed to be about. If we could see those actual authorities, that would be helpful.
Director Halbach.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we will work on that for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Halbach.
To that point, Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Halbach. I just wanted to make it clear that I don't think Representative Duszkowski necessarily speaks for most of us when he's talking about the agency's work and pollution prevention and helping Minnesotans use less and put less environmental pollutants out into our environment. And so, you know, I think the Office of Environmental Assistance has done some fantastic work over the last few years, and I think it's important that the MPCA continues that. And it's a lot, you know, when I've looked at spending millions and millions, tens of millions of dollars in my district, and our local, both our local, state, and federal governments cleaning up pollutants in trying to do some redevelopment, I think the focus on prevention and helping people figure out better ways to do things to use less, we're saving money all around, both in the short term and in the long term. So I just want to thank you for the good work the agency does in that area.
Continue, Ms. Halbach.
I will jump to page 15. And again, this objective is about reducing the overall emissions in sulfur and nitrogen oxides. I won't spend a lot of time, but when you look at the bottom of this page, you will see the four different funding sources that we were provided to reduce particulates in diesel engines. One particularly is we have redone all of the eligible school buses. That's those buses that have technology before 2007. And so we actually protected the health, not just the reducing of the emissions, but the health of those students who ride the buses, 236,000 students, and that was the primary reason that was done, was the health impact to students and the diesel fumes to do. We've also had a federal public vehicle grant, which is, again, working in the congested area, so this was Minneapolis and St. Paul. It's to reduce that mobile source air and the potential impact that we do have. And that is really where we did the fire trucks, the snow plows, street sweepers, again, those in the heavy congested area to do. Then we received a federal diesel reduction grant for additional heavy trucks, and that's where we helped work with fleets in the trucks, and that they were able to reduce their costs along with the reduction in it. And then there were stimulus funds for this area as well. And we provided that. Now, we typically worked with Clean Air Minnesota, which is a public-private partnership, to do, and the Minnesota Environment MEI gave grants out as well, and so we combined our resources to maximize this. And much of the legwork on the actual getting the school buses done was by MEI. It was not by us. We managed the contracts and the grants part of it and helped connect people. So that's the role that we played in these four grants. You can see that some of the folks saved legitimate money. They told us they were able to stay in operation by the switchovers. They were eligible to stay both in business because they reduced the amount of fuel they needed, but also they were eligible to drive their trucks in states like California that have more restrictive air requirements. So it gave them opportunities for their business to do. And so those are some of the quotes from them. We also let you know, and we tried to put it in terms of vehicles, the actual emissions reduced from those areas. It was a very successful program. It is one of the areas that the federal government for sure is looking at potentially reducing. We have grant applications in for the next round, but this may be one of those areas not funded in the future.
Ms. Hallback, if I remember right, there was a transition in the big trucks 3-4 years ago. You're dealing with trucks that didn't that were produced before a certain year. This will not be an ongoing issue. The new vehicles, new school buses, fire trucks, dump trucks, etc., meet new guidelines that this work is not going to apply to. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. 2007 is the date. So those done after 2007 aren't eligible because their technology takes care of this. Those before 2007. And so, it'll be a while for the transition, but absolutely there will be a place where this is not needed. But particularly long-haul trucks, we all know, drive a long time.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Hallback. Members, you may remember if you had any constituents bring to you that they were somewhat dumbfounded at the substantial increase in vehicles at a time when our economy was really moving forward, thank goodness, because it was a huge, huge increase in their cost of doing business and this. But here's an example of where we won't have the ongoing costs to deal with. Representative Dill, do you have a question?
Yes, and I don't think it's for Ms. Hallback, but something that I'd like to have some information on is, Mr. Chairman, other states, California is an example, provinces in Canada where they have large communities, Toronto, Ottawa, all Quebec, places like that have gone away from diesel on fleets and gone to compressed natural gas. And I'm wondering if, as Minnesota's facing the idea that we may not be an entertainment for the metro area, is there any move to go to compressed natural gas? It apparently works well in those areas. It's almost all, many of the vehicles, street sweepers, garbage trucks, municipal vehicles, many thousands and thousands of those vehicles are on compressed natural gas. But I never hear about that in Minnesota, especially as we move towards the possibility of non-attainment. So it'd be nice to have some information on that.
Ms. Hallback, if I'm not mistaken, the district that Representative Swazinski represents, where Schwann's is headquarters, uses those vehicles currently, if I'm not mistaken, throughout the state of Minnesota, not only in the metro area. Do you, or maybe you can get some information back to us on how that is expanding, that type of vehicle.
Mr. Chair, we will get you the information, but those vehicles are used, but you're right, they're not talked about greatly. I think we'll also be moving quicker into electric battery vehicles, particularly if you think about airports. They've been moving that direction as well. And so there are other opportunities beyond this.
Continue, Ms. Hallback.
Let's see where I am. Middle of page 16.
Ms. Hallback, I apologize. I'm actually going to stop you. Okay. Members, we need to approve the minutes from yesterday. Representative Drazkowski moves the minutes. All those in, or discussion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Members, members, we're going to continue tomorrow with Ms. Hallbeck, and so meeting adjourned.